Ms. Gambino, whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Judge Williams, Judge Sykes, and Judge Tinder. On behalf of Mr. Garrett this morning, I'd like to begin by discussing the application of Alain versus the United States, or Alaini, however the court would like to pronounce it, and the Fair Sentencing Act. It's our position, first of all, that the jury was improperly instructed in Mr. Garrett's case. The defense submitted instructions asking for the amounts that were found appropriate under the Fair Sentencing Act of 2010. And the court rejected this, opining that nobody had found that the Fair Sentencing Act was going to be retroactive, and so he would stick with the old amounts. The difference being a submission of the 5 grams and 50 grams to the jury, or the 28 and the 280 grams to the jury. The 5 and 50 were submitted, and the jury found 50.
Now, but then he got the benefit of the new, the 28-gram level, didn't he, at the sentencing process?
During the sentencing process, yes, the judge found that the mandatory minimum would be appropriately 5 years and then doubled with respect to the 851 enhancement, which I will address also. However, under Alain, the Supreme Court said clearly that this is not sufficient. The same argument was made and rejected by the dissent in Alain, and what the Supreme Court said about that is that the essential Sixth Amendment inquiry is whether a fact is an element of the crime. When a finding of fact alters the legally prescribed punishment so as to aggravate it, the fact necessarily forms a constituent part of a new offense and must be submitted to the jury. It is no answer to say that the defendant could have received the same sentence with or without that fact. And that's at 133 Supreme Court 2162 in the Alain case. So it is not an answer here either to say that he could have received the same sentence. And the problem that arises is when you have a jury finding of 50 grams, it's neither the mandatory minimum of 28 nor the mandatory minimum of 280. And what actually happened in this case was that the judge even went beyond that to make a finding that he should be sentenced according to 2 kilograms of crack cocaine, which would have called into play the mandatory minimum of 280, which was never addressed. So apart from, you're in a sort of an awkward situation where the jury's made a finding that's exactly between the 2 mandatory minimums in the case, and the judge goes ahead and sentences above the mandatory minimum that was
as a matter of the guidelines, though, not...
Pardon me?
As a guidelines matter, not as a statutory matter.
Certainly. But the argument with respect to the guidelines matter, particularly in this case, is that the increase was based on unreliable evidence.
Right, but that's a separate argument. The judge didn't do fact-finding for purposes of the mandatory minimum here. The judge accepted the jury's finding of over 50.
Right.
But adjusted the legal analysis based on the Fair Sentencing Act minimums. And because the jury found over 50, that necessarily includes over 28, right? So
it does, but that doesn't answer the question that's left by the Supreme Court in Alain.
We have a jury finding that gets your client into the mandatory minimum that he received.
Exactly.
So there isn't a constitutional problem. The jury made the finding.
Well, in fact, what the court says is that you can't say that they made this finding or...
Well, over 50 includes over 28.
It does, but it doesn't
include... So the jury made the finding.
The jury made the finding of over 50. It did not make the finding of over 280, which is where...
But you're not saying that Judge Zagel treated it as though the mandatory minimum was based on 280 grams, are you?
No, I'm not saying that.
In fact, he specifically announced the lower mandatory minimum.
That's correct. I'm not arguing with that.
Right. He increased it by virtue of the prior conviction, which is
Which is a separate issue, which I'll get to in a moment.
Right. So we don't have an Alain problem. We may have a problem of a collateral attack on the prior conviction, but that is a separate issue.
Well, I do think we still do have an Alain problem because I think that the jury was not asked to find the appropriate mandatory minimum in this case. And that's what the Supreme Court says. It's not a question about what happens after the fact or the fact that he could have received the same sentence. They were improperly instructed about what the law was, and they weren't asked to find the we don't know what they would have done with 28 and 280.
But what they did was they found a lower mandatory minimum than he could have been exposed to.
They did.
So it's hard to see how he's harmed by that.
They could have also rejected it, found the 28, found the 280. We don't know what they would have found. And what Elaine says is that the important thing is that this is now an element of the crime. It's not a sentencing factor. And so it matters who makes the decision. And in this case, the jury didn't make the decision according to the law. The jury made a decision according to an incorrect interpretation of the law.
Before you move on to your second sentencing issue, you know, should we agree with you? Is your client aware that if we sent this back for resentencing, there's a possibility he might receive a higher sentence?
He is aware of that.
And you've advised him of that?
I have.
And he's prepared to go forward with this appeal?
Yes.
All right. Go ahead then to your second argument.
Now, the second argument is with respect to the imposition of a finding of 2.8 kilograms. Now, the court based this entirely upon Mr. Garrett's alleged post-arrest statement, which Mr. Garrett testified he, in the first instance, did not make. And there was no corroboration for that statement. And that's evidenced by the judge's own discounting of the appropriate guideline in this particular case, based on the fact that he had some questions about the validity of the defendant's post-arrest statement. So he gave him a two-level discount, so to speak, from the guideline range that he found. And it's been the position of this court, as well as the Supreme Court, that there is a due process obligation to sentence a person based on reliable information. And particularly in a case like this one, in which you're talking about if this court had chosen, or if the district court had chosen to do a one-to-one equivalency between crack and cocaine, for instance, this would have started off at a level 20. With the Fair Sentencing Act, it would start at a level 30 for the amount that was demonstrated at trial, which was a single transaction of 241 grams. Instead of taking either of those amounts, the court, based on an alleged statement, increased the sentence significantly to a question of kilograms, and there was absolutely no evidence to support kilogram-level dealing between Mr. Garrett and anyone. So this wasn't a case of using reliable information to increase the sentence, and this, too, was in violation of Mr. Garrett's right to due process in sentencing. And then we get to the third issue in sentencing, which was the 851 issue. And Your Honor, in the last case, asked about Almendarez-Torres and whether that had been weakened by the decision in Elaine. And I would argue, while they haven't directly overturned it, certainly they have substantially weakened it by their position in Elaine. And while the government suggests that the rationale underlying treating prior convictions separately is based on the problem with recidivism and the history of the law in this area, I would say, as applied to Mr. Garrett, those factors don't apply. Also, the concern about prejudice in introducing a prior conviction into a trial, I would suggest in this case, would not have applied in the same way it might in many other cases. And the reason for that is that Mr. Garrett's prior conviction was in 1993, so it was more than 20 years old. And what happened in that case, it was a one-day plea and sentencing situation in which there was a stipulated agreement between Mr. Garrett's attorney and the state's attorney about the possession of approximately 3 grams of some substance, which at one point in the transcript was referred to as cocaine, and at another point was referred to as codeine. And without Mr. Garrett's direct participation in the process, without being directly asked by the judge in the state court whether he agreed with this and accepted it, the plea and sentencing were done on that day. And that has subsequently been found to be a violation of Illinois law, which requires that when there's the equivalent...
This argument is a collateral attack on the prior conviction, which is not permitted in the context of federal sentencing, unless there was a denial of counsel, which there wasn't in this case, which is a structural kind of error that a federal court can recognize in the context of federal sentencing. But ordinarily, a collateral attack on the state sentence isn't available. And this is apart from the Aileen Almendarez-Torres issue.
Well, actually, Your Honor, while I agree that ordinarily it's not a part of it, 851E provides for that kind of a collateral attack. 851E provides
for
that.
Within 5 years.
But they have a five-year, yes, they do have a five-year limit on it. But in this case, I would submit that the five-year limit acts to defeat the purpose of that provision of the law. Because basically what you're saying is, well, if he does it within 5 years, you know, that's okay. If the case is even older and even less reliable and even less indicative of his recidivism, we're not going to let you address it. So
we just have to read the five-year limitation out of 851?
No, but I think that when the five-year limitation in 851 works to the detriment of the purpose of the law or
it's
violates...
It's always going to do that as the convictions get older. It's always going to do that.
Well, then I think that to the extent that it does, particularly in this case where it's so extreme, when we're talking about 20 years and we're talking about a misdemeanor case of possession of a questionable... Well, not a misdemeanor, I'm sorry, it's a Class 4 felony. Possession of a tiny amount of drugs, that doesn't tell you what this law was intended to do. The enhancement was for recidivist drug offenders. And this was a 20-year-old conviction with no subsequent drug conviction is not a good indicator of recidivism in Mr. Garrett's particular case. So it doesn't really accomplish the purpose of the statute if the purpose is to punish more heavily and more severely those drug traffickers who are incorrigible recidivists, you know, that's not Mr. Garrett. And
Judge
Zagel
gave him a discount, didn't he?
He did. He gave him a three-level discount from a guideline range that I would submit was inappropriate in the first place.
Right, but it seems as though the judge accounted for the age of the conviction by giving him a discount.
Well, it's hard to tell what he accounted for because he could have been accounting for the fact that he's imposing a sentence based on kilogram quantities of cocaine while he's saying that he can't really tell if the kilogram quantities he's using are relevant or appropriate to this case because there's no reference to dates, times, or all that kind of information that you'd like to have to make it reliable and use. So he's sort of saying, at least it seems from the record, that you know, I realize that there's a problem with increasing his sentence so substantially based on this statement, which we don't have any corroboration for.
So it was a discount for drug quantity, not the age of the prior.
It's hard to say because he wasn't specific. He could have given for both of those things, for one or for the other, but we don't know because the record is not clear enough on that point. But the discount that he gave doesn't come anywhere near where this case should have been sentenced, which was at what was proven at trial. And this court, as well as the Supreme Court, in the context of looking at elements of the offense, has found that the defendant's uncorroborated statement alone is not sufficient to prove an element. And if we're talking about drug quantity, which we are here, the line between element and sentencing factor is blurred and all but disappeared post-Elaine, it's really inappropriate in a violation of due process to impose a greater sentence based on an uncorroborated statement that the defendant has contested.
You're in your rebuttal time. Do you want to save your time, Ms. Gambino?
Save some time, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Schneider?
Good morning. May it please the Court. With respect to the FSA Aileen issue, I would simply note, as the Court has noted, that we do know precisely what the jury would do here because they, in fact, did it in this case. They made a finding of 50 grams of crack cocaine. They were only required under the FSA quantities to find 28 grams, and the judge imposed a sentence consistent with the lower 20-gram quantity, which was to the defendant's benefit.
Before you go on, I want you to address this quantity issue because the only testimony about the 2 kilograms was Labneau's testimony recounting what he said that Garrett said to him. And when you look at the sentencing transcript, the judge didn't really adopt the PSR. In fact, he said, I'm discounting two levels because there's uncertainty as to the quantity in this case, and not solely because of simply one person taking another person's word or not taking another's word. I think because there's no reference to the recency of the specifics of the admissions or the context, and so he discounted two levels, so he never really made a specific finding on quantity.
Well, I think he made a 2-kilogram quantity finding, Your Honor. But in considering the kind of totality of the circumstances, some of the nature of the information that was given in the post-arrest statement, he discounted that significantly.
And so where in the transcript does he say the 2 grams? I mean the 2 kilos?
I think he addresses the basis of his discount in the transcript at page 41.
That's what I just read to you.
Right.
Right. And he doesn't say anything about adopting that. He talks about that uncertainty, and so that's, I mean, he says the offense level is 36. He says he's discounting because there's uncertainty as to the quantity.
Well, I think
so
the...
How else are we supposed to read that? That doesn't seem very precise, or that he's making a specific finding.
I think given that he agreed that the offense level was 36, that was, in effect, his finding of drug quantity as to 2 kilos, which was what the evidence, the only evidence with respect to quantity in addition to the particular charge transaction was. And this court has held in cases like Johnson that a defendant's admission to a law enforcement agent based solely on the testimony of a law enforcement agent is sufficiently reliable to establish the extent of a defendant's drug quantity. And here you actually had some independent corroboration in that the 2-kilogram transaction that he described was with Isaiah Hicks, the same person that he was intercepted and convicted of engaging in this drug trafficking activity for. And as the court notes, the effect of the 2-kilogram, the 2-level reduction that the court applied by way of a variance, in effect, was to reduce the effective drug quantity level to 280 to 840 grams. So a level 34 with respect to the drug quantity prior to the 2-level obstruction enhancement, a level 34 is 840 grams to 2.8 kilos. He discounted that by 2 levels, which goes to 280 to 804 grams. The evidence in this case was...
But he never really explained how many grams or kilograms it was actually counting as relevant conduct. And we've said before that the district court can't simply select a number without at least some description of reliable evidence used to support the finding and the method used to calculate it. That's right out of Claybrook's. So, for me at least, it's difficult to discern what reliable evidence he relied on to arrive at the 36 offense level. See, that's what I'm trying. I know he said 30. I mean, I know 36 was the number, but there's no discussion of it. And so it seems ambiguous when he talks about the uncertainty.
Well, I would also point out that the judge expressly credited the agent's testimony, which was challenged in the context of the suppression hearing and challenged in the context of the question of consent to the search of the cell phone. So the judge had made a credibility determination.
So then what's the discount for?
Mm-hmm. I can't say more than what the court said, which was that
which may be the problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's inspecific with respect to the recency. For example, in looking at the criminal history point, and to your point, Judge Sykes, there was not only a 3-level reduction in offense level, but he also knocked off 4 points of the criminal history calculation based on the fact that some of the criminal history points were not in accord with what the judge described the defendant's current life to be.
But this evidence that you say, you know, in terms of the findings at the suppression hearing or at other prior proceedings, didn't find its way into the sentencing transcript, did it? Finding that the agent, Garrett, was credible, for example, it never made its way into this sentencing transcript.
Well, I think the government certainly pointed out at the sentencing, if I'm remembering correctly, that the judge had made a credibility determination already with respect to that agent's testimony.
But the court never made any reference to it after that argument was made, or the court was reminded of it. I'm trying to look now to see where that is in the transcript, but it's just a little unsettling that even if that's the case that you pointed out, when we get to the actual time when he's supposed to make a finding, he doesn't say that or reiterate it or say, you know, there's some uncertainty because I'm not sure about some of these things, but I've credited Agent Garrett's testimony, and so I'm comfortable that it's 2 kilograms.
Well, what I would say, Judge, is that the only testimony was 2 kilograms plus the evidence of the transaction that was charged in the case. The court expressly credited the testimony of the agent, which was the basis for the 2 kilogram statement that was included in the PSR and that the government relied upon.
What you're saying is that we should now, when we're doing sentencings, also look back at prior rulings of the court to help support the court's finding at the time of the sentencing.
I think if there's a question as to whether the testimony of a witness or the basis that the court's relying upon comes from a witness is reliable or not, and the court has made a factual or credibility determination with respect to that witness's testimony, I think that would be appropriate for the court to consider.
It doesn't matter when the court makes that determination. Essentially, that's what you're saying, so we can look beyond the sentencing trend, the four corners of the sentencing.
I think in this context that is appropriate. And what I would say, too, is that with respect to the two-level discount that the court applied, that dropped the drug quantity, the effective drug quantity number, to 280 to 804 grams.
I totally get that. I'm just saying there's no rationale, there's no explanation given when he did it. That's what's missing.
And the drug quantity finding of the evidence at trial of the charged transaction was, I believe, about 241 grams. So this is the effect of what the judge has done has been to add only 40 grams on top of what was convicted for at trial. So if this had ever happened before, and the defendant was clear that he had engaged not only once before, but to a substantial quantity before, you immediately get into that 280 to 804 gram level. And I think the evidence is certainly more than sufficient to establish 280 grams, which was what the judge actually used in imposing sentence in the case.
What was the factual basis in the PSR for the drug quantity? Was it the confession?
I believe so, yes, Judge. The 2 kilogram quantity was based solely on the statement given by the defendant to the agent. I don't have the PSR in front of me itself, but that's my understanding. And I would just note also, Judge, then, with respect to the 851 question that was raised, to the extent that the defense now brings this claim under Aleen and Almendarez-Torres, I would note that was not something that was an issue, I believe, forfeit in the district court. It was raised for the first time in defendant's reply brief and is arguably waived here. But in any event, the Supreme Court in Aleen declined to overrule Almendarez-Torres. And it's, of course, the prerogative of the Supreme Court to overrule its own precedent. In any case, it doesn't really matter here because the challenge to the 851, for a number of reasons. One is that the sentence imposed was 190 months when the mandatory minimum was 120 months. So it's clear that the mandatory minimum didn't have an effect on the sentencing. And insofar as defendants sought to collaterally attack the underlying conviction, that was done nearly 10 years beyond the statute of limitations time limit. And in any event, the district judge here looked at the transcript of the state court proceedings and found that it did apply with the Illinois law. So he, in fact, gave the defendant the benefit of the doubt in reviewing the underlying conviction and found that it was compliant with the Illinois rules with respect to how pleas are taken. So there was certainly no error in application of the 851 enhancement, but even if there were, it would be harmless given the 190-month.
Well, getting back to this uncertainty, the court had on the drug quantity was the PSR. So he was referring to the PSR when he was speaking about this uncertainty, correct?
Well, he had
because
the PSR.
He didn't have time, you know, more specifics around it.
He had the PSR and he had the evidence at trial.
Right. Which he didn't make any reference to the evidence at trial either in the sentencing, did he?
I don't
believe. As it relates to quantity.
As it relates to quantity, no. But I would say again, Your Honor, that the evidence at trial was clear that there were 241 grams involved in that transaction. There was testimony by the, or there was a statement to the agent. The agent's testimony was deemed credible, in which the defendant admitted doing 2 kilograms more. And to get into the drug quantity finding level that the court actually applied, you only need to get about 40 grams more than was actually proved at trial. And we think the evidence here is more than sufficient to establish that. And insofar as the court's explanation wasn't as robust as it was might have been, we think on this record it's very clear what the district court was seeking to do, what the court, in fact, did in imposing a sentence that was well below the guidelines in this case. And we would ask that the sentence and the conviction be affirmed, subject to any questions the court might have.
We have no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Gambino, how much time? All right.
I think, Your Honor, if you are permitted to go outside the sentencing record and look at other aspects of the record in this case, that raises some more complicated issues. For example, Mr. Garrett was the go-between between Isaiah Hicks and Patrick Jones. Patrick Jones pled guilty in his case. He also had a statement that was similar to Mr. Garrett's about having done other transactions mediated by Mr. Garrett, but that wasn't held against him, and he was sentenced only in accordance with the transaction between he and Mr. Garrett that was the subject of the trial. So if you want to go outside of the sentencing record, then you raise a whole different set of inequities to discuss about why and when a judge decides to use the defendant's statement, uncorroborated as it was, against him, because he did in Mr. Garrett's case and did not in Mr. Jones' case. Also, we're not talking about a matter of 40 grams here, and even if we were only talking about 40 grams, that represents a year or more of a person's life. And if the sentencing were properly done, based on a 5-year mandatory with a 1-to-1 ratio, we would have been talking about 31 to 51 months. So we're not talking about simply a matter of, well, the judge sort of did the right thing and we ended up in the neighborhood. We're talking about a difference of many, many years in Mr. Garrett's life. And this court has said repeatedly that speculation is not an appropriate basis for imposing sentence, particularly when you're talking about a case like this in which the evidence concerned only a single transaction on a single day. And there's absolutely no corroboration in the trial record for what the judge did at sentencing.
Thank you, Ms. Gambino. We'll take the case under advisement.